Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Needless to say, many of us are concerned, and rightly so, about the situation that happened in Minnesota. And there is a right response to this. I've seen the unfortunate polemics that usually takes place. Catholics, my friends, we have to be better. We have to redraw the lines here back to the virtuous mean, which is the line of the teachings of the One Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, which means don't give in to the usual knee-jerk outrage and examine the information with reliable resources for information, like the National Catholic Register, for example, or in certain situations, other publications like the Free Press. And when you assess this, you realize that what we need is not just a sense of decorum, but a regaining of virtue. So I'm going to begin by talking with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. And we will speak about Archbishop Hebda and his statement that it is only by working together with God's help that we will have peace in our community, state, and the world. I want to make clear, Archbishop Hebda is not calling for some kind of kumbaya utopia. When he talks about peace, he understands that there is a limitation to the fallen human nature, and yet peace, reasonable peace, is still attainable with virtue, with Christ and His Church. And that's what we need right now, prayer and a sense of calm, not knee-jerk reactions. We go on from there to speak with my friend Dr. Billy Kangas. He and I will be leading a pilgrimage to England in September, and it's because England and the British Commonwealth are in my blood and in my bones, and there's a deep Catholic root to England that we need to reclaim for the sake of Christ re-evangelizing Europe and the world. And so you can go on avemariaradio.net and click on the slider to find out more about this pilgrimage to England. Finally, we will speak with David Bonagura about Christ's peace and the next new thing that arises that might rob us of that peace. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, January 8th. It's the feast of Our Lady of Prompt Succor. And today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria Family of Funds at avemariafunds.com. The FBI is taking sole control over the investigation into the deadly shooting of a woman by an ICE agent in Minnesota yesterday. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension said it was notified that it would no longer have access to the case material, scene evidence, or investigative interviews necessary to complete a thorough and independent investigation. After the shooting, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the woman refused commands to get out of her vehicle and tried to harm the officer with the car. The Senate is setting up a vote to restrict President Trump from taking further action in Venezuela without congressional approval. The upper chamber agreed to start debate on the War Powers Resolution in a 52-47 procedural vote after a handful of Republicans joined Democrats. Trump could still veto any resolution to limit his power if it were to pass in Congress. 100 people are reported to have been killed in Saturday's U.S. operation that captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. A large number of dead include Maduro's security team and some 32 members of the Cuban military and intelligence services working in the country. Maduro's wife, Celia Flores, who was also captured, reportedly sustained a head injury in the raid. And NASA is considering bringing the crew of the International Space Station home a little early because of a medical issue on board. The agency didn't say which astronaut or what the issue was, only that the situation is stable. The crew consists of two Americans, one Japanese astronaut, and a Russian cosmonaut. They arrived in early August for a planned six-month mission. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Ox Peter, joined by my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. And we are talking about church news, current events, a light of church teaching. And Dr. Matthew Bunsen so generously joins us from the heart of the church today, physically. Matthew, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Oh, great to be with you. Happy New Year to everybody, and also greetings from Rome.
Now, coming from what was once the seat of the great Holy Roman Empire, are you feeling that great surge of another crusade?
Not tonight, but talk to me tomorrow.
Now, it actually is opportune that you are in Rome, because there's quite a lot of news pertaining to the Holy Father. But before we get there, let's start with the news about the Arizona bill and why it's concerning.
Yeah, this is a sort of rinse and repeat, I think. Mm-hmm. We have seen a number of bills over the last few years being introduced that would essentially create felony charges for priests if they fail or refuse to break the seal of confession under the precise circumstances of supposedly after learning about an incident or of child abuse during the sacrament of confession. So this particular measure was introduced at the end of last year. Now it's obviously going to have to await action by the state house. But what it does, once again, is to call into question the validity of the seal of confession. And two things are immediately to note. The first is that the church has been extremely clear in cooperating with police, but also equally clear that under no circumstances can a priest violate the seal of confession, and certainly as part of any mandatory reporting laws, and that priests and bishops are willing to go to prison rather than violate that. And then we can add one other important point, and that is that in the face of a number of states that have attempted to require priests to violate the seal of confession, those have been consistently defeated by courts because of the rights of the church in that regard.
And like you mentioned, this is rinse and repeat, because you and I have spoken about multiple cases like this from different states, and it's always the same thrust. What's hilarious, too, is it's the priests and the Catholic Church that are targeted, but tell us about how they treat, say, therapists and lawyers.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's what we have seen consistently in a number of these bills is that they tend to grant waivers or exclusions to a lot of so-called child care professionals, psychiatrists, and others. So there seems to be this effort, and I'm not casting a blanket criticism of these laws, but certainly there does seem to be an effort that hyper-focuses on the church. And I think that creates some real problems, not just legally, but also in creating more and more difficulties for priests to serve properly. Now, when we look at a variety of states, I think of Delaware, Wisconsin, Montana, Vermont, all of them have proposed these types of laws. Now, most of them don't end up becoming law precisely because there are so many constitutional problems that are faced with that. But they are continuing to do this, and I think they are doing that in the hopes that they will eventually find some kind of a federal court that allows these laws to stand. Ultimately heading to the Supreme Court, happily at least so far, we know that the Supreme Court has been extremely consistent, in many cases 9-0, in cases that involve the rights of the church, the rights of priests, and everything from the ministerial exception to various seals of confession, that sort of thing.
It really is concerning, because one thing that this bill does not take into account is the kind of person who goes to confession is the kind of person who's seeking grace and conversion.
Right. I think they've seen too many movies where murderers present themselves for a confession with the whole point of trying to either trap a priest or scandalize him or draw him into some sort of a diabolical web. Let's stay with reality and let's stay focused, too, on the fact that priests, again, are willing to go to jail, to prison, rather than break the seal. And we can talk about various cases in church history where priests have in fact been killed. They have been martyred, put to death for refusing to break the seal of confession. And the codes of the church are very clear about the absolutely sacred aspect of the seal of confession. Otherwise, it destroys the sacrament and all everything that surrounds it. So again, we're seeing these efforts very clearly to demolish what are the traditional rites of the church, and note how they always go after some of these key sacraments of the church.
The charges here are also rather absurd, because looking at a class six felony, the charges that would be brought if a reportable offense is not reported, and they can lead up to 150,000 fines and 2 years of imprisonment. I mean, they're pulling out all the stops here. It's not going to go very far.
Right. And it reflects in some ways, too, the fact that post child sex abuse crisis that the church has grappled with, they are very focused again on trying to push the church to break and or violate certain things that are held to be sacred. Now, they do so under the guise of protection and everything else, but as you know, look at the severity of the penalties that they're proposing for this, and the wording even of the law itself that's being offered here is that it would amend the state code to require priests to report abuse learned during confession if they have, quote, a reasonable suspicion to believe that the abuse is ongoing, will continue, or may be a threat to other minors. That is itself, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll leave it to lawyers to discuss that, but that seems very open-ended in terms of what reasonable is. Not to mention the fact that, once again, it imposes these very severe penalties for what is deemed a reportable offense.
Severe is the word. And undoubtedly, you and I will keep talking about this as this endeavor inevitably dies out. It's going to be laughable, but like you said, it's rinse and repeat, and this won't be the last time. I'm going to switch gears very briefly to talk about the ICE shooting of a U.S. citizen. What do we know, and what virtuous stance ought we to have about this?
Yeah, so this is a case, of course, that has really garnered an immense amount of frustration on a lot of people. We are seeing how so much of a powder keg we are currently facing nationally, and it's a reflection in some ways as terrible as anyone who shot and killed, under regardless of the circumstances, that the divide that is emerging in this country that seems to be, and I stress seems because I think this is something that we can overcome, but the political divide, the cultural divides in this country are escalating to the point where we're seeing consistently now this sort of violence in the streets. And very often, when you have an incident like this, as I use the word, it's a powder keg that can explode very suddenly. And I think this is one of the reasons why we have seen efforts on the part of church leaders. In this case, Archbishop Hebda of Minneapolis, you know, Archbishop Bernard Hebda, one of the things that he's asking for is an effort to lower the temperature of rhetoric. And I think that's, for a lot of people, that's the tone that we need to have now. As he put it, he was pleading for all people of goodwill to join me in prayer for the person who was killed, for their loved ones, and for our community. And I think that at this point is what we need to be focused on, and where we pray for the loved ones, we pray for the person that's killed, but, and here's the important part, As he says, we continue to be at a time in this country when we need to lower the temperature of rhetoric, and I think he's right.
Matthew, thank you so very much for making the time to speak with us. I'm very grateful.
Great to be with you. God bless.
My guest has been Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. We've been talking about church news and current events in light of church teaching. Catholics, we have an obligation to hold moral fidelity in public in the love of Christ. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. In September of this year, from September the 20th to the 29th, my friend Billy and I will be leading a pilgrimage to England. And this is going to draw on the deep love I have for the British Commonwealth. Love for England runs deep in the bones of many of us who grew up in the Commonwealth, especially since we were fed a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment, when in reality, Catholicism is the bedrock and foundation of a lot of what makes England great and can still make England great if it reclaims it. As I mentioned, joining me to have a conversation about this is Dr. Billy Kangas. Billy, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Oh, I'm so good. It's great to talk to you, Marcus, and about such a exciting opportunity. I'm so glad to be here.
So let's talk about the information night so that people know that there's an avenue for them to get more information.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we've got this trip coming up, and before people commit to going across the pond with us, we want to make sure they know what it's all about. We get to tell them about the highlights, walk through the itinerary, answer questions. So we're partnering with Corporate Travel, and they're hosting an information night next Thursday where people can go online and talk to us about this trip that's coming up. So it's a great opportunity to connect with Marcus and myself, with the Corporate Travel who's organizing it, and learn more about the trip.
And we'd greatly invite you to go on avemariaradio.net and click on the slider that takes you to the link for the information page. It's January the 15th at 6 p.m. We'll have the information on the website. Now, let's talk about the trip itself. So in a grand scale, Billy, let's just touch on why it's important for us to reclaim the Catholic identity of England. Europe at large, sure, but particularly England right now.
Yeah, England is in a very interesting place. I was reading studies where if you go to England on a given Sunday today, for the first time since the Reformation, there's more people going to a Catholic Mass on Sunday than going to an Anglican service. Mm-hmm. And so understanding how is it that this Catholicism, which has always been there, but in many ways has been the victim of an extermination effort for many years in the past, has found its footing, and how that spirit of the gospel, which was planted there, has taken root, and we're seeing a lot of hope in there. And I know both you and I are people who have been greatly enriched by the Catholicism mm-hmm. that England has offered the world. There's been many great writers and thinkers and theologians and saints that England has produced. So we want to be able to explore that, and I think that will give us an opportunity to understand the moment that we're in as well. So Marcus, I'm curious, you know, why do you care about England personally?
Well, it was brought up British, right? So English history informs the way we think. British English informs the way we speak. And so with a healthy dose of Shakespeare, some Tolkien to some degree, but not much, largely because Malaysia is very Islamic as well. And so they forbade the import of a lot of Lewis books, Tolkien books. But the point is, the British system of education, the British way of thinking, is just ingrained across the Commonwealth. Malaysia was a British Commonwealth nation until 1957. And what England did for the world, and sure, we could talk about the empire and the colonization and whatnot, but what England did for the world, quite literally, I speak English for the same reason Americans speak English, that the British took over these lands, was driven in large part by a lot of the heritage that it received from its Catholic identity. And that's the thing that many people don't realize. In 597 AD, Pope Gregory the Great sent St. Augustine of Canterbury to England as a missionary, to evangelize England. He was so successful that it turned this land from pagan Germanic into virtually entirely Catholic. And for 1,000 years, or just about 1,000 years, this land was so deeply Catholic. Oxford, Cambridge, they're all Catholic heritages. And as you and I have talked about, the corpses of many churches and cathedrals, they're all deeply inherently Catholic. The architecture is Catholic, Gothic, for the most part. And when I became Catholic, studying that heritage made me realize that we lost a lot with the Protestant Reformation, the declaration that was given by the king that sovereignty is owed and allegiance is owed to the king and the crown over and above Rome. From then on, we've seen the decline of England's morality and faith. And so I believe this is a time for Catholics to go to England to reclaim its Catholic roots, because like you were mentioning, the Catholic faith is seeing a resurgence. There was a member of the royal family who was interred in a Catholic funeral, and it hasn't happened in just about 500 years now, which tells us a lot, that there's a shift in the cultural tide. It's slow. Islam and modernism, progressivism, are proving to be problems, but Catholicism has deep roots in this land called Our Lady's Dowry. So that's why England holds such a heritage for me. I want to invite you to share some of the experiences, including the literary experiences, that helped shape your life from English authors.
Yeah, so in my own journey, I was not born as a Catholic myself, but I'm a native English speaker. And on my journey to the Catholic faith, I found there's all these great Catholic writers that inspired me. You mentioned Tolkien, of course, but the ones that really impacted me on my journey to becoming Catholic were converts themselves, which is G.K. Chesterton and John Henry Newman. And those two people, when I was in the thickest of trying to wrestle through this question of, is the Catholic Church a true thing? Is it something I can give my life for? Reading their own struggles and their own responses to that was really helpful to me. So for me, I love that there was this part of English culture that couldn't be exterminated. There's this light that, in spite of tremendous persecution, wouldn't go out. And that's one of the things I do to this day. I love reading the stories of the English martyrs. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that we want to highlight on this trip is, yeah, there's this tremendous wealth of literary life from both people who were born in the church and English writers who discovered the truth of the church. And that was all because from St. Augustine of Canterbury all the way through the English martyrs to today, the Holy Spirit has been at work in this island.
Yeah.
And that's in spite of our sin, all of these things. But I think it's fascinating, and there's such a testament to the faithfulness of God and the truth that he seeks to draw us into in the lives and writing of these people. And as an English speaker, it's great that we can connect to these voices that go back like that and can inform our life as well.
Now, I will say as a loyal American that we did throw tea in the Boston Harbor, yes? So we cast out the crown and its influence, and proudly so. God bless America. But we should also remember that the English Enlightenment, if you can call it that, plus the English biblical heritage, Catholic heritage, paved the groundwork for things like the Magna Carta, which became forerunners for the way we think about liberty and the dignity of the human person and rights here in the United States of America, which means going to England isn't a disdain on the American identity. If anything, it gives us historical context to know that the heritage we have is historically greater than even 250 years. And of course, our founders greatly expanded on it. So I want to greatly invite everyone listening right now. We're going to have an information day on January the 15th. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and sign up for the information day. Find out about this event, and we would love to see you join us on this pilgrimage to Catholic England, to reclaim the Catholic footsteps of England, to walk in the places where the blood of the martyrs was shed, and to join in their sacrifice, that we may experience what I believe to be an historical turning point in the re-Catholicism, re-Catholicization of England. My friend Billy Kangas and I will be leading this pilgrimage from September the 20th to the 29th of this year. Once again, AveMariaRadio.net. January 15th. Go on, click on the slider and sign up. We'd love to see you there. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces." If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we? The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
What is one of the most challenging doctrines of the Catholic Church to comprehend? It is the mystery of the real presence of Jesus Christ in the sacrament of the Eucharist. The Catholic Catechism tells us that Christ is present to his Church in many ways, but most especially in the Eucharistic species, and that his presence in these species of bread and wine is unique. The whole Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity, is truly, really, substantially contained therein. In other words, under sacramental signs, he is physically as well as spiritually present. St. John Chrysostom declares that man does not cause this miraculous occurrence. A man, the priest, acting in the role of Christ, does pronounce the words, but it is Christ himself whose power and grace brings about the transformation of the bread and wine into his body and blood. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John chapter 11, verses 21 to 26. This is the story of Lazarus. Lazarus has died. Lazarus is one of his best friends. Just before this passage, we hear the news that Martha and Mary send word to Jesus that the one you love is sick. And the next line in the scripture is, now because Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus, he stayed where he was. His friend's in need. He can heal. They've seen him heal before. And yet somehow, because he loves him, he stays. And Lazarus dies. And then Jesus shows up 3 days later and is greeted by Martha and Mary, who confront him with the words, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would never have died. Rather applicable for many of us in our lives. We ask the Lord to do one thing because we're certain it is what we think is best, when in fact he has something which far surpasses what we ask for. The challenge is, in waiting for that to happen, we go through very trying times, which oftentimes makes us wonder, does he really care?
Maria in the Afternoon, 2025 Year in Review.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Vita.
Something has begun to trouble me over the past year. For a while now, I've been writing cultural and political commentary, and they've been getting published in numerous publications, but what's been perturbing to me has less to do with disagreement and more to do with a collapsed sense of shared intellectual posture. After each of my articles appear, especially in venues that invite public comment, a familiar spectacle follows with remarkable predictability. Many of the readers arrive already armed, already certain, and already sorted into camps and tribes rather than schools of thought. What unfolds under each article in the comment boxes is not engagement with Catholic moral reasoning. It actually closer resembles the ritual exchange of slogans and pithy, uninformed, tired talking points. That pattern deserves examination because I think it reveals something deeper than disagreement over policy or prudential judgment. I think we're in a place of cultural condition when Catholic virtuous mean has lost intelligibility. Aristotle once described virtue as the difficult discipline of proportion, discernment, and restraint. The Church baptized that insight into a moral vision, united it with divine revelation, and then made it capable of navigating the complexities of any age. Today, that moral grammar feels foreign even to many Catholics, because they increasingly read every issue through prepackaged ideological lenses rather than through the Church's intellectual tradition. And all discourse collapses into caricaturization. In economics, one either genuflects before markets, in capitalism, or demands totalitarian collectivist state control. In race, the options are either hypercriticism and accusatorily so, or managerial DEI. In politics, we must either pledge allegiance to conservative or liberal factions, as if the gospel demanded a party badge. In media consumption, we choose either between establishment control or conspiratorial drivel. In public argument, speech alternates between pugilism or nihilism. I mean, each of these domains forces a binary, and each of these binaries rewards constant outrage. The angrier we are, the more these things are fed. And this environment renders Catholic teaching suspect and insane by default. A writer who insists on moral limits, historical context, and principled virtuous restraint appears insane, incoherent, because our audiences now are trained to expect constant, extreme absolutism. As a result, the same author can receive accusations that cancel each other out in spectacular fashion constantly. In less than a year now, I've been labeled as Lily White MAGA, but an Obama fan, a racist apologist, and a Republican defender, but also a Democrat spokesperson, and Uncle Tom, and being on the AIPAC dole, and also a capitalist, and also endorsing socialism and collectivism. I mean, the laughable contradictions are indescribable. The humor of these contradictions would delight Chesterton, but the implications are actually more concerning. Because many readers, many of us listening right now, we approach discourse, we approach issues with our conclusions already fixed. More often than not, we're scanning for confirmation or we're scanning for reasons to be offended. The article itself is incidental. And this dynamic explains the financial success of outrage peddlers, because these people understand the economics of attention. Drip feed conspiracy para-journalists, you know, people like Candace Owens, they thrive on feeding suspicion in calibrated doses. Why? Because it keeps audiences perpetually agitated, but agitated enough that they keep returning and never exhausting the cow of conspiracy. And the model is lucrative because modern audiences don't care to think about the complexity of situations. And into this environment, we throw in apocalyptic language. Recent rhetoric across social spectrums and political spectrums increasingly frame issues as final debates. This is the most important XYZ. Get this wrong and everything's over. I mean, this language is borrowing theological imagery, but it's stripping it of theological discipline, because the effect raises stakes to cosmic proportions. And so, well, then yeah, take the intellectual shortcuts and moral excess. Because if everything's apocalyptic, then you have to be worried. Because when politics become salvation history, then campaign cycles become the gospel. And scholars of political theology document this pattern with care. Numerous people like Alison McQueen, Arthur Brooks, they observe that apocalyptic framing dissolves moral restraint. In other words, the more apocalyptically we think, the more we don't guard our morality. And we start thinking of ourselves in a panicked manner, and we start thinking of our opponents as embodiments of evil. And once that shift occurs, well, ordinary moral lines are no longer important. History is useless. The world's going to end. Civil War preachers, during the Civil War, they invoked violent psalms to sanctify brutality because they were convinced that they were participating in divine judgment. The lesson throughout history endures. When political identity absorbs sacred meaning, we give permission to cruelty every single time. And psychology has reinforced this. People like Jean Lewis have noted that religious imagery activates archetypal fears that narrow our thinking. Why? Because fear simplifies. Fear polarizes. Fear elevates strongmen. Fear invites populations to trade thinking for protection. These conditions are fertile ground for authoritarian people, for commentators who want to peddle more fear, to build an audience base, for example. The language of doom does a tremendous amount of emotional work, more effectively than even political policy. A significant percentage of Catholics hold apocalyptic beliefs, and that frames politics and even whatever we do in society as a zero-sum contest in which defeat is catastrophic. In that light, loss feels existential, and morality goes out the window. Now, none of this comes from a vacuum. Our American history has a long tradition of this kind of apocalyptic understanding. But I want to caution all of us. Theology resists this kind of misuse. Stripped of context, the scriptures can be mobilized for politics or for agendas rather than as a revelation of the love of God and divine mystery. Christ suffers under the brutality of an empire, but that empire receded. Christianity continues. My friends, we who believe in Christ have nothing to fear, nothing at all. Because the church will endure, the gospel will endure. And that's why the irony becomes unmistakable. At the end of the day, our call is above civility. We have to become credible again. But the way we do that is by thinking rightly and responding rightly, which means, please, let's cease the knee-jerk outrage. Let's be real rational neighbors. Let's be real thinking citizens, virtuous citizens, because then we will regain credibility, because grace will allow our intellects to guide us to conduct ourselves in manners of virtue in public discourse. If we don't, well, the alternative promises endless outrage and ever-shrinking understanding. And that's not going to bode well, because then reason will be cast out the window, charity would be cast out the window, and outrage and disagreement will rule the day. We have a tradition that guides us beyond anything else. We have scriptures to teach us how to do it. We have a God who tells us that we should do this. Many people will put forth their own agendas and interests, but Catholics, we have the obligation of the evangelization of the entire culture across the world for the salvation of souls. Because it's the only thing that matters at the end of the day. Salvation in Christ Jesus and the embrace of His one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Do you feel as though life is flying past you? Are you desperate for a way to find moments of peace and quiet? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Stephen Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
What rituals does your family have? Family rituals aren't just nice things families do once in a while. They have to be regularly scheduled activities that everyone's expected to show up for. Family meals, family prayer time, game nights, movie nights, family days, family chore times are all examples of family rituals if they happen at regular, consistent times and everyone is expected to participate. Strong family rituals help a family become a real team. Research also shows that strong family rituals are the most important ways families communicate their faith and values to their kids. Family rituals teach us what's important to make time for, and that's why the rite of family rituals is one of the most important practices in the liturgy of domestic church life. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I come from the other side of the tracks, see? My uncle used to have slot machines. Put one nickel in and it's emptied. And I brought him home in a bag, and my mother looked at me. Where did you get all that money? I said, I won him. You didn't win him. He fixed the machine. I didn't care if he fixed the machine or not, you know?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. 6 years ago, the world was being enraptured with the COVID pandemic. In the years since then, there's been an election, the rise of AI, numerous social media scandals, and other viral stories. Whatever the next new thing will be is anyone's guess, but we can safely say it will consume our attention, generate fresh anxieties over how it will upend our lives, and then just as flash in the pan as it was, it will be forgotten. Joining us to have a conversation about this is David Bonagura, author most recently of 100 Tough Questions for Catholics, Common Obstacles to Faith Today. David, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Hello, Marcus. I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Always a joy to reconnect. So let's talk about the current intellectual milieu as a way of framing this conversation. There was a point where, as a culture, we were capable of non-outrage-driven, sustained thought, but that those days seem to be gone.
That's pretty funny. Non-outrage-driven, sustained thought. Yeah, now our thought is not sustained. It is instantaneous. It is fleeting, and it is rage-driven almost all the time. And yeah, the idea of actually thinking about something and weighing it and considering it, who needs that? But what's amped up is the way in which you respond to everything is so fever pitch. Even something that's not necessarily political, something that's not life-threatening, even everything is everything gets to a DEFCON level 3. That what the nudist thing that comes out on the news, and every news that work on everybody's phone and everybody's media this and podcast that and on and on and on. And boy, is it exhausting, and is it all distracting? Not to say it's necessarily unimportant, but I love the word distract. It literally means to drag away. And if we have the, God help anyone who has the 24-hour news media, you know, coverage running on the television, because that is the most distracting thing, to drag one away from family, friends, God, something, just being normal. All that constant refrain and badgering, it can't be good. There's something about being able to step away and not allow these things, what are these newfangled things, whatever the latest craze is, whether it be something political, something in the news, whether it be some new gadget or toy or AI device or stock market thing. There's something to be said that the need to be able just to back away and say, I'm going to go do something else. I'm not going to let this thing control me. And you know, just wanting to continue turning to our phones and to social media, that just heightens the problem. It doesn't give us the space that we need to be non-reactive, thinking, reflective people, as you said in your opening.
Even before we talk about becoming thinking, reflective people, just have the wherewithal and discipline and fortitude to step away and take a breath, rather than engage in what we've become conditioned to, which is this knee-jerk, explosive outrage.
Totally. To take a breath, to step away, and to realize that my immediate response or some other talking head's immediate response to whatever is the latest thing on the news really doesn't matter, and it's not helping anyone, and it just contributes to turning up the temperature rather than contributing to finding out the truth or the good or the beautiful. There's something, it's just too much. And there's a thing called spiritual freedom. I mean, we know it's freedom. Spiritual freedom means that my spirit, my being, is not controlled or dominated by any other factor. And whether that be my iPhone or the news or whatever the latest political scandal is or whatever the latest newfangled thing is, spiritual freedom means I can separate myself from it. I can turn my iPhone off and go in the other room for 3 hours and not worry about it. That is spiritual freedom. And it's something that we all, myself included, any of us, we really need to strive to cultivate. It is a discipline. It's a virtue that takes time. It doesn't just, you know, not just, oh, I've got to pray for spiritual discipline and then get it 2 seconds later. It doesn't work that way. You should pray for it, but you have to work at it and do things like, okay, I'm going to put my phone in a drawer from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. I'm not going to look at it. And almost everybody who does that finds, wow, it was so freeing not to have that thing. And then, of course, we all just go back to it, right? But nevertheless, to give us a little bit to have control over these things and not let them control us. Because when they control us, then our moods go sour and we can become grumpy, angry, all these things that we don't want to be when we let the news and newfangled things take control of us rather than assert our spiritual freedom over these things and say that I am not going to be mastered by them. They will serve me, but I will not let them dominate me.
Did you feel a disturbance in the force the moment you suggested, yeah, put your phone away for 3 hours?
I know, right? It's amazing to be able to do that. And it's always, I've been turning the phone off earlier and earlier every night, and believe me, I don't regret it. Except for at night with, darn, what's the weather going to be tomorrow? So other than that practical issue, other than that, I'm very happy to have the thing turned off. Because there's so many things you just don't need to be worried about, and they can wait until tomorrow.
There's another part of framing this conversation that we need to address, which is how all of this constant barrage of information, the truth is we are bombarded so much now that the human nature isn't made to receive and process as much information as we're receiving so constantly. And so we're in this heightened state of anxiety that disconnects us from connecting with God interiorly.
Exactly. I mean, what do we need? God is found in the silence. God is found in the stillness. The story of, I believe it's Elijah, where, you know, God is coming by. He expects God to come by in a storm. He doesn't come by in the storm. He doesn't come by in the wind. He comes by in a quiet whisper. And when we have all these things going on in our lives, they prevent us from hearing God. And of course, there's things that need to be done during the day, right? We understand that. But it's this, what's letting them consume us, take away our freedom, to enslave us. That's when we disconnect from God. And think about it, what is it, world, a world that's secular, it's worldly. Well, what's an easy way? I am as guilty as anyone. We can quickly blame this factor and that factor, this person or that person, this force or that force, for trying to take God out of our culture. But in fact, the more things that we have in our culture that consume our attention, the less room we all have for God. Because, well, if our attention can only, as you were suggesting, our attention can only go in one place at one time. And when we are constantly going to this thing, this worldly thing, where do we find time for God in that? Where do we find time to pray? What is time with God? What is faith? It's just simply developing a relationship with Him. Every relationship takes time. And the more things that we have crowding our life, the less time we have for God. So that's really the big danger. And why do we have a secular world? Well, this is a big part of it, because we have so many things that take away our attention from looking at the Lord, and it takes time and effort to simply look at Him and see what He wants to communicate to us.
And we have great wise teachers throughout the church's history that give us ways to do this while still, you know, keeping our feet in the social and even political development of the culture we live in, like Augustine, for example, with the City of God.
Right, exactly. Augustine gives some great advice to people, you know, caught up with newfangled things and the latest thing. And in his case, it's talking about the fall of the Roman Empire. But what does he do? He gives eternal advice. He doesn't turn to influencers, or we don't need the latest techno wizard to tell us, oh, we need to do this, 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 this. He goes to St. Paul, and he goes to the Gospels. He means he goes to the Lord Himself and finds some advice for us. And what are some things that we need in order to, and precisely to develop inner peace and to be able to see God? The first thing we need is self-regulation. One of the things Augustine's quotes from St. Paul is, do not let the sun set on your anger, which is just terrific advice on every level of life. We need to have the courage to correct the moral faults of others, but he also says that we need to do that in the right way. You know, going to correct your brother with a screed on Twitter is probably not the best way to approach that. And finally, we need to be able to just to have that calm. We have self-regulation. We have We have the correction of us, and we need to have the calm that comes about through forgiveness, which is the ultimate thing, really, that God wants us to do, to forgive others 70 times, the, you know, the whole hour, the crux of the Our Father, which we say how many times a day, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And forgiveness, of all three of those things, self-regulation, correcting others, and forgiveness, forgiveness of the three is really, it's the hardest one to do, but it really is the one that gives peace, because it's the inner peace, and when we have peace, we could see God, because it helps us let go of all these worldly things. When we need to forgive somebody, or we need to be forgiven, we become wrapped up and consumed in the temporal moment. God is not in that picture. It's us and the other person and the wrong that's done. And yes, okay, justice needs to be done and all that. But there's an element of forgiveness, of letting go. It's so difficult. But the fruits of that, those are the fruits of the Spirit. Those are the fruits of a good and holy life and a happy life. And Augustine in the City of God points that out very clearly.
David, you highlighted something so crucial. One of the reasons we engage in knee-jerk outrage is because we're immediately offended by this thing that this person did online. We don't know them personally, but we're now offended. And so what you're saying is, no, we now are in a position where we need to forgive them, and that's the remedy for that outrage.
Exactly. To let go again. It's really difficult to forgive. Now, forgive, what does it mean? It doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to have warm, fuzzy feelings about another person who wronged you. It just simply means that you're not going to harbor anger or anxiety toward the person, and you're not going to think ill will toward them, right? So the classical definition of love is to will the good of another. Think of Erica Kirk's famous public forgiveness of her husband's assassin. Right? What an example to all of us that was, right? So what does it mean to forgive? It doesn't mean that she doesn't want him to go to jail. It means that she is no longer harboring a grudge, anger, or resentment toward him.
I'm talking with David Bonagura. He's a prolific author, professor, and David, I'm really glad that you've had this conversation with us. Thank you very much for joining us. And take to heed David's advice, which is that we need to focus on forgiveness and keeping our lives grounded in virtue and in Christ. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.